Welcome to a podcast from the American Academy of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery on the recently developed clinical practice guideline on improving nasal form and function after rhinoplasty. This guideline appears as a supplement to the February 2017 issue of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery, the official journal of the American Academy of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery. My name is John Krause, the editor-in-chief, and for this podcast, I am joined by the chair of the guideline panel, Dr. Lisa Ishii, who joins us from the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland, and also by Dr. Michael Setson, another of the guidelines authors, who joins us from the New York University School of Medicine and the North Shore University Hospital in Great Neck, New York. So I'd like to welcome you both and start in right away with you, Dr. Ishii. And I thank you for taking time out and joining us this evening and for certainly doing the excellent work on this guideline. As a facial plastic surgeon, I know that you frequently see patients coming into your office and they present with concerns about both the appearance of their nose as well as the function of their nose. And many of these patients are coming to you because in their mind they're seeking a surgical solution. Can you first explain for our listeners so they understand and we're all on the same page, how does the study panel, the guideline panel, define the term rhinoplasty?
Absolutely. And Dr. Krause, thank you so much for having us this evening and allowing us to talk about this new guideline. So to your point about the definition, the panel spent a significant amount of time on the definition because we wanted to get it just right for the purposes of the guideline and the audience. And we wanted to be sure to convey that we were capturing a procedure that had the opportunity to both change the shape and appearance of the nose, as well as either preserving the nasal airway or enhancing the nasal airway. So to the point that you made, we're referring to a procedure that is both cosmetic and possibly functional in nature if there is some intent to improve breathing by enhancing the airway.
Okay, and I think that's important, and I'm glad you explained that because I think the conception among some people is this is a purely cosmetic procedure, but really in terms of what the panel was looking at, it was looking at not only the effect of surgery potentially on the appearance, but as well as the effect of surgery on function. So that's correct.
Absolutely. Yes? Absolutely.
Okay, great. So Dr. Setson, thanks for joining us this evening on this podcast. And as an otolaryngologist and rhinologist in private practice, and as someone who does both functional and cosmetic rhinoplasty, I know that you see a large number of patients primarily for nasal complaints on a daily basis. And I guess what I'm wondering then, in your thoughts, why do we have a guideline now focused on rhinoplasty? What was the purpose, as the panel described it, for getting together and publishing this piece of information for the medical community?
Dr. Krause, thank you very much for the warm welcome and inviting me alongside Lisa to participate in this important podcast. This guideline is important in particular for, you know, the rhinologist and private practitioner because, as Lisa said, not only does this operation improve appearance, but it also strives to maintain or improve nasal function. And as we all know, the happiest patient following rhinoplasty is one who not only looks better, but breathes better through their nose. Furthermore, the rhinoplasty patient, you know, may have nasal congestion due to allergic rhinitis and or sinusitis, and this may need to be evaluated and treated before the procedure. What's also interesting from someone like myself, many a time I'll be evaluating a patient for nasal congestion, and while we're scheduling their functional surgery, they'll say, "Doc, you know, while you're about it, why not just take down that little bump on my nose?" So that's important if you don't do that kind of procedure to invite a colleague, such as a facial plastic surgeon, to assist you as the otolaryngologist or rhinologist to work in tandem together so that this operation can be done one time.
And I think that's a very good point. And rhinoplasty is a common procedure, certainly as I understand it. And, you know, what is the economic burden? You know, how frequent is this? And what really are the costs, both direct and indirect, of rhinoplasty surgery?
There are both direct and indirect expenses related to rhinoplasty. Obviously, the indirect expenses are those where the patient is not going to be able to attend work as they recover from the week following rhinoplasty surgery. But the direct expenses are those attributed to the surgical fee of the procedure. That procedure usually costs in excess of about $4,000, depending on where it is done in the country. Operating room fees, anesthesia fees, and obviously other incidental fees related to the surgery. Other direct expenses, of course, may occur if complications arise, if the patient gets a post-op infection, or what if they need a revision rhinoplasty. Overall, about 200,000 rhinoplasties are performed each year, Dr. Krause, with the direct expenses topping in excess of $1 billion per year, as it did in 2014. So rhinoplasty is commonly done. It's becoming more and more commonly done as this is more and more socially accepted. So one anticipates those costs and the burden to society will increase.
Interesting. Dr. Ishii, do you want to add to Dr. Setson's comments?
Yeah, he really captured it incredibly well. I would just underscore the point that both of you made, which is that it's one of the most commonly performed cosmetic procedures, both in this country and around the world. So it's something that we're dealing with on a truly routine basis, particularly in light of the fact that cosmetic surgery is becoming so much more commonplace as it has become available to so many individuals and has become socially acceptable.
And that really does underscore the need for a guideline at this time. So, Dr. Ishii, as you and your colleagues state, the purpose of this was not really to be a compendium of surgical techniques or a how-to manual on rhinoplasty surgery, but there were other goals that you and the panel had in mind. Can you tell the listeners what was the scope of the guidelines recommendation and how were these intended to be used?
Absolutely. So we were really excited at the amount of data that was available in the literature around perioperative management. So to your point, we made the conscious decision not to reflect on specific techniques of the procedure that occur in the operating room, but rather focus our attention on the steps that lead up to the surgery and those following the surgery. Because again, there actually is a lot of data about both of those areas. So we were able to delve into preparation for the patient, both from a psychological standpoint and from a physical standpoint up until the surgery. And then we were able to reflect on postoperative management, thinking about pain control, thinking about whether or not the patient would need an antibiotic, thinking about follow-up. So critical parts of the procedure, just not the technical aspects, but we're really excited about being able to optimize the outcome for the patient, thinking about the perioperative management as opposed to the technical portions.
Right. Fabulous. And we'll come back and talk a bit more about some of those in a few minutes. And you mentioned comorbid medical conditions, and certainly the understanding of those and the management of those are critical. Dr. Ishii, can you give us a little bit of a background on obstructive sleep apnea as a comorbid condition? This, I think, as we think about surgery in our patients, is an important comorbid condition that we need to consider and manage. And are there specific recommendations in the guidelines that address obstructive sleep apnea?
There are. And to your point, you know, it was very interesting in the comment period for the guideline. It was brought to our attention, well, what about diabetes? What about heart disease? What about other comorbid conditions? And we said, you know, the reason that we paid particular interest to obstructive sleep apnea was that that's one that specifically for rhinoplasty is one of concern because it impacts the airway. So patients with obstructive sleep apnea who are going to undergo an airway surgery, we need to be particularly cognizant of that, both to be able to prepare them for the procedure and understand the best way to manage them, but also to give them some insight into how the surgery could impact their sleep apnea and if it could do so positively, for example.
Okay, great. So Dr. Setson, let's come back to you again. There's a delicate balance when you do a surgical procedure on the nose between making it appear the way that you would like it to, but at the same time, not adversely affecting the function. And there is that balance, I think, that you as a rhinologist or facial plastic surgeon needs to consider. How do the guidelines recommend that you counsel patients about this? What sort of instruction should you give to the patient in the preoperative period? And then afterwards, are there specific ways you can go about assessing both appearance and function?
Jack, thank you. This is an important question. From my standpoint, I think this is the most important key statement, that the surgeon or their designee should evaluate the rhinoplasty patient for nasal airway obstruction during the preoperative assessment. There is a preponderance of evidence over harm supported by level C evidence supporting this key statement. So you should evaluate the nasal obstruction on history, which we always do, and then examine the nose via anterior rhinoscopy using a nasal speculum or nasal endoscopy determined at the discretion of the operating surgeon. If nasal endoscopy alone is necessary because anterior rhinoscopy didn't show any pathology, then use the nasal endoscope. This will allow you to look further into the nose for the deviated septum posteriorly. One can look at the ostomatal complex. There may be sinus problems, purulent drainage, nasal polyps, adenoidal hypertrophy, and even nasal and sinus tumors. So many people don't use the endoscope, but I think if that need arises, this should occur. One should then evaluate the nasal function with respect to nasal valve collapse using the caudal maneuver. Following this, one should document on a patient questionnaire via the SNOT-22 or a nose scale what the nasal function is. The patient should then be counseled that nasal function can be improved if they have nasal congestion by correcting that deviated septum, correcting turbinate hypertrophy, helping their sinus problems, and maybe even improving nasal valve weakness. The problem is too many rhinoplasty patients are just evaluated for appearance, and that is why the statement is so important that nasal function must be evaluated before this operation.
And I think that makes a critical point. Dr. Ishii, let me follow up with you on that because I think it is a critical point. As you're thinking about doing maneuvers that are going to change the shape of the nose, how do you go about that? How do you counsel your patients? What do you tell them? How do you assess that as you make a change in the structure of the nose? How do you anticipate what might happen in terms of the function in that patient?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's actually a critical part of the conversation because probably the vast majority of patients who are undergoing rhinoplasty want some element of making their nose appear smaller. And mm-hmm. So when you talk to them about either preserving or possibly enhancing the nasal airway, they immediately become concerned that rather than their nose appearing smaller, it's going to appear larger.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm,
it
right.
is absolutely vital. And I usually use very clear diagrams of the nose showing the upper lateral cartilages, the lower lateral cartilages, the septum, explaining the relationships of them, explaining the aesthetic ideals and showing them that, in fact, we can still, for example, take their hump down and make their nose appear smaller while still maintaining the internal nasal valve with spreader grafts, for example. But mm-hmm. it really is. It's such a key point to make sure they understand we can't compromise their airway, but we do need to achieve the cosmetic goals that are their wish.
Okay, perfect. So in addition, you know, Dr. Ishii, I'm sure you will see patients come into your office for a variety of reasons and seek rhinoplasty. And at times, that patient's goal, I suspect, may be unrealistic. How do the guidelines suggest that you actually do that assessment and analyze and appreciate the patient's goals and objectives for surgery, as well as putting those in the context of any comorbid psychological issues that may be important for you to understand?
Absolutely. So the very first action statement is about communicating expectations. And it says clinicians should ask all patients seeking rhinoplasty about their motivations for surgery and their expectations for outcomes and provide feedback on whether or not they are realistic. So to your point, we were very deliberate with the wording here to suggest that the clinicians caring for the patient who may undergo rhinoplasty for someone else or the surgeon who is performing rhinoplasty or both really should have a very meaningful, detailed conversation with that patient about exactly what they're trying to achieve from it. Because the worst possible scenario is that the patient undergoes surgery and the patient comes back, says, gosh, this isn't the nasal tip that I wanted. I wanted something different, but you didn't elicit that from them. Or even worse, that the patient comes back and says something like, gosh, I thought with my new nose that I was going to be able to save my marriage, and that's not happening.
Yeah. Right.
And so really, this is just about, you know, we all want what's best for our patients. We want our patients to ultimately be satisfied and happy with their results. And so this says, take the time up front to have a meaningful conversation with the patient and make sure that you're on the same page with them about their desires for the procedure and that they aren't asking for something that will alter their life in some way that really doesn't make any sense. So one condition that we are particularly concerned about with cosmetic patients is body dysmorphic disorder. And as it turns out, there's actually a very simple screening tool that's highly, highly sensitive for body dysmorphic disorder. And probably for patients who don't have body dysmorphic disorder, but are on a spectrum of unrealistic expectations. And that's called the BDDQ, the Body Dysmorphic Disorder Questionnaire. And there are actually literature to show that you can administer that screening tool quickly and easily within your routine clinic flow and be able to get a red flag on patients who perhaps either you need to spend more time on counseling or perhaps they're not good candidates at all.
Good. You know, I think those are really, really important points for our listeners as they consider and integrate this into their decision-making process around rhinoplasty. So, Dr. Setson, recent guidelines have really stressed the input of consumers, and the guidelines panels over the last several years have stressed having lay participation in guideline development, guideline review, as well as in preparing clear, plain language summaries for consumers so that they can have an intelligent discussion as well with you as a surgeon and be making those decisions in the most informed manner. What do you recommend and what do you offer as guidance directly to consumers who are contemplating rhinoplasty surgeon? What kind of things should a patient be thinking and asking when they come to talk to their surgeon about having this procedure done?
Lisa addressed that very briefly as well when she said one of the key statements is that you should educate the patient on all levels with respect to this operation. Educate them on what to expect during the surgery, after the surgery, how this might affect their ability to breathe through the nose. As Lisa mentioned, some of the times when we do a cosmetic procedure, we can affect breathing. So we need to let the patient know that if for some reason there were a change in their breathing, that revision surgery may be necessary. We also need to let them know that complications can occur. We need to go into those complications in detail. And if the revision surgery was necessary, what this would entail. We need to let them know that this operation is twofold. We're going to improve their appearance, and then we're going to improve their ability to breathe through the nose. We need to let them know exactly how they're going to feel in that immediate postoperative period. They're going to be nasally congested. They're going to have some bleeding through the nose. They're going to be swollen. They're going to be bruised. We need to let them know we'll manage their pain and swelling with painkillers, raising the head of the bed, ice pack, herbal treatments, and let them know exactly whether or not they can participate in contact sports early on, and what those restrictions will be. If you do this, you will help make this a very positive experience for the patient and enhance the outcome.
Good, good. And I think that's important. And certainly having an educated patient and having that patient be an active participant in their care is certainly something that's going to enhance that outcome, as you said. So thanks for bringing that out. It's excellent advice. Dr. Ishii, you mentioned earlier antibiotics, and certainly I think a question in nasal surgery has always been, should or shouldn't we use antibiotics? And likewise, nasal packing. Is there a role for nasal packing? So what do the guidelines suggest about these two specific interventions, antibiotic use and nasal packing with rhinoplasty surgery?
Yes. So with regards to the antibiotics, it says that if the surgeon chooses to administer antibiotics, that they should not routinely be given for more than 24 hours. So in other words, in your routine nasal surgery, Don't do it more than 24 hours if you're going to do it at all.
Okay.
For the nasal packing, and I'll be very clear that we have a specific definition for nasal packing in the guideline, and it does not include sialastic stents or nasal splints. But that should not routinely be placed in the nasal cavity at the end of surgery either.
Okay. Okay. And Dr. Seth, what might be a situation where nasal packing or some sort of splinting might be necessary or might be consistent with the guidelines?
If there were excessive bleeding following the procedure and one couldn't control the bleeding at the time of surgery, then nasal packing may be necessary. But as Lisa said, try avoid it if at all possible. And if you do need to use it, only use it for a very short period of time, maybe a couple of hours to a maximum of 24 hours. Remove it the next day. With respect to nasal splinting, sometimes splinting is indicated if significant septal surgery is necessary, and then sometimes patients will use a splint in that case. If indeed you do pack your patient or you do use a nasal splint, in that situation, antibiotics may be necessary for a longer period of time, longer than the 24 hours, if the splint and or the pack needs to remain in place longer than the 24 hours.
Okay. Okay, good. And again, it highlights that there may be circumstances in which surgeons need to use their judgment based upon the specific circumstances of that individual procedure. So thanks for pointing that out. So, Dr. Setson, we're about to wrap up our podcast, and I'm going to first call on you. Do you have any other final thoughts for our listeners, any other comments or pieces of advice that you can recommend to our listeners concerning the guideline and its implications for patient care?
Jack, I'm just going to say there are 10 statements that should be addressed with each patient. And simply, it's ask your patient why they want surgery, elicit their expectations, evaluate comorbid conditions, educate them with respect to the post-op management, ask about nasal congestion, and then the discussion on antibiotics, painkillers, steroids, and nasal packing, which Lisa discussed, are the key things in this guideline. It's a very easy guideline to follow, and I think physicians and others taking care of the rhinoplasty patient will be able to use these 10 key statements and move forward and give their patient quality care in the rhinoplasty patient.
Great. That's good advice. So, Dr. Ishii, I'm going to ask you to close in a moment. Dr. Setson mentioned steroids. We hadn't talked about that. What do the guidelines recommend for the use of oral steroids following rhinoplasty surgery?
The role of steroids is interesting. The data were a lot more mixed with regard to steroids. So we said that they could be administered, so we didn't feel strongly that they should be or that they shouldn't be. And that's just based on the mix of the information that's available on steroids in this type of procedure.
Okay, so it's an option for surgeons, but you don't have a recommendation either for or against.
Exactly.
Okay, great. So the last word is yours. We're closing our discussion this evening. What take-home message would you like to offer our listeners as they prepare to read this guideline and then consider its recommendations and opinions?
Absolutely. I would just underscore what Michael already said. It's not a radical guideline, but we're very excited that it is full of very practical information to allow the surgeons to proceed in taking care of their patients in an evidence-based way, in a very sound way that will lead to the best outcome for the patient. So we hope that they'll find it to be an incredibly useful tool. I know that I have already changed my practice based on the information that we found in the literature review, and we hope that others find it as useful for them. We feel confident that we're going to see improved outcomes for patients in the long run.
Fantastic. And again, thank you and your panel for doing the incredible amount of work and taking the time to do this, because it will have impact on us as surgeons as well as on our patients. This will conclude our podcast on the recently developed clinical practice guideline on improving nasal form and function after rhinoplasty. My name is John Krause, and I'd once again like to thank our participants, Drs. Lisa Ishii and Michael Setson, two of the authors of the guideline. I encourage you to read the full supplement to the February issue of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery, also found online at www.otojournal.com. Thank you very much, and we look forward to having you join us for a future podcast.